pie-hole.
He turned back to Arnie and put his meaty hands on his wide, well-padded hips.
I know a creep when I see one, he said, and I think I'm looking at one right now. You're on probation, kid. You screw around with me just one time, and it don't matter how much you paid up front, I'll put you out on your ass.
Dull fury went up from my stomach to my head and made it throb. Inside, I begged Arnie to tell this fat fuck to bore it and stroke it and then drive it straight up his old tan track just as fast and as far as it would go. Of course, then Darnell's poker buddies would get into it, and we'd both probably end this enchanting evening at the emergency room of Libertyville Community Hospital, getting our heads stitched up. But it would almost be worth it. Arnie, I begged inside, tell him to shove it and let's get out of here. Stand up to him, Arnie. Don't let him pull this shit on you. Don't be a loser, Arnie. If you can stand up to your mother, you can stand up to this happy asshole. Just this once. Don't be a loser. Arnie stood silent for a long time, his head down. And then he said, yes, sir. The word was so low it was nearly inaudible. It sounded as if he was choking on it.
What did you say?
Arnie looked up. His face was deadly pale. His eyes were swimming with tears. I couldn't look at that. It hurt me too bad to look at that. I turned away. The poker players had suspended their game to watch developments over at stall 20. I said, yes, sir, Arnie said in a trembling voice. It was as if he had just signed his name to some terrible confession. I looked at the car again, the 58 Plymouth, sitting in here when it should have been out back in the junkyard with the rest of Darnell's rotten plugs, and I hated it all over again for what it was doing to Arnie.
All right, get out of here, Darnell said. We're closed.
Arnie stumbled away blindly. He would have walked right into a stack of old bald tires if I hadn't grabbed his arm and steered him away. Darnell went back the other way to the poker table. When he got there, he said something to the others in his wheezy voice. They all roared laughter.
I'm all right, Dennis, Arnie said,
as if I had asked him. His teeth were locked together, and his chest was heaving in quick, shallow breaths.
I'm all right. Let go of me. I'm all right. I'm okay.
I let go of his arm. We walked across to the door, and Darnell hollered at us.
And you ain't gonna bring your hoodlum friends in here or you're out.
One of the others chimed, and leave your dope at home. Arnie cringed. He was my friend, but I hated him when he cringed that way. We escaped into the cool darkness. The door rattled down behind us. And that's how we got Christine to Darnell's garage. Some great time, huh? Chapter 6. Outside. We got into my car and I drove out of the yard. Somehow it had gotten around at past 9 o'clock. How the time flies when you're having fun. A half moon stood out in the sky. That and the orange lights and the acres of parking lot at the Monroeville Mall took care of any wishing stars there might have been. We drove the first 2 or 3 blocks in utter silence. And then Arnie suddenly burst into a fury of weeping. I thought he might cry, but the force of this frightened me. I pulled over immediately. Arnie, I gave up right there. He was going to do it until it was done. The tears and the sobs came in a shrill, bitter flood, and they came without restraint. Arnie had used up his quota of restraint for the day. At first it seemed to be nothing but reaction. I felt the same sort of thing myself, only mine had gone to my head, making it ache like a rotted tooth, and to my stomach, which was sickly clenched up. So, yeah, at first I thought it was nothing but a reaction sort of thing, a spontaneous release. And maybe at first it was. But after a minute or two, I realized it was a lot more than that. It went a lot deeper than that. And I began to get words out of the sounds he was making. Just a few at first. Then, strings of them.
I'll get them, he shouted thickly through the sobs. I'll get those fucking sons of bitches. I'll get them, Dennis. I'll make them sorry. I'll make those fuckers eat it. Eat it. Eat it.
Stop it, I said, scared. Arnie, quit it. But he wouldn't quit it. He began to slam his fist down on the padded dashboard of my duster, hard enough to make marks.
I'll get them. You see if I don't.
In the dim glow of the moon and a nearby streetlight, his face looked ravaged and hag-like. He was like a stranger to me then. He was off walking in whatever cold places of the universe a fun-loving god reserves for people like him. I didn't know him. I didn't want to know him. I could only sit there helplessly and hope that the Arnie I did know would come back. After a while, he did. The hysterical words disappeared into sobs again. The hate was gone, and he was only crying. It was a deep, bawling, bewildered sound. I sat there behind the wheel of my car, not sure what I should do, wishing I was someplace else, any place else, trying on shoes at Tom McCann's, filling out a credit application in a discount store, standing in front of a pay toilet stall with diarrhea and no dime. Any place, man. It didn't have to be Monte Carlo. Mostly, I sat there wishing I was older. Wishing we were both older. But that was a cop-out job. I knew what to do. Reluctantly, not wanting to, I slid across the seat and put my arms around him and held him. I could feel his face, hot and fevered, mashed against my chest. We sat that way for maybe 5 minutes, and then I drove him to his house and dropped him off. After that, I went home myself. Neither of us talked about it later, me holding him like that. No one came along the sidewalk and saw us parked at the curb. I suppose if someone had, we would have looked like a couple of queers. I sat there and held him and loved him the best I could and wondered how come it had to be that I was Arnie Cunningham's only friend. Because right then, believe me, I didn't want to be his friend. Yet somehow, I realized it then, if only dimly, maybe Christine was going to be his friend now too. I wasn't sure if I liked that either, although we had been through the same shit factory on her behalf that long crazy day. When we rolled up to the curb in front of his house, I said, "You gonna be all right, man?" He managed a smile.
"Yeah, I'll be okay."
He looked at me sadly.
"You know, you want to find some other favorite charity. Heart Fund, Cancer Society, something."
"I get out of here."
"You know what I mean."
"If you mean you're a wet end, you're not telling me anything I didn't know." The front porch light came on, and both Michael and Regina came flying out, probably to see if it was us or the state police come to inform them that their only chick and child had been run over on the highway.
"Arnold!"
Regina called shrilly.
"Bug out, Dennis,"
Arnie said, grinning a little more honestly now.
"This shit you don't need."
He got out of the car and said dutifully,
"Hi, Mom." "Hi, Dad."
"Where have you been?" Michael asked. "You had your mother badly frightened, young man." Arnie was right. I could do without the reunion scene. I glanced back in the rearview mirror just briefly and saw him standing there, looking solitary and vulnerable. And then the two of them enfolded him and began shepherding him back to the $60,000 nest, no doubt turning the full force of all their latest parenting trips on him. Parent effectiveness training, EST, who knows what else. They were so perfectly rational about it, that was the thing. They had played such a large part in what he was, and they were just too motherfucking and fatherfucking rational to see it. I turned the radio on to FM 104, where the block party weekend was continuing, and got Bob Seger and the Silver Bullet Band singing Still the Same. The serendipity was just a little too hideously perfect, and I dialed away to the Phillies game. The Phillies were losing. That was all right. That was par for the course. Chapter 7. Bad Dreams. When I got home, my dad and my sister were sitting in the kitchen eating brown sugar sandwiches. I started feeling hungry right away and realized I'd never gotten any supper.
"Where you been, boss?"
Elaine asked, hardly looking up from her 16 or cream or tiger beat or whatever it was. She had been calling me boss ever since I discovered Bruce Springsteen the year before and became a fanatic. It was supposed to get under my skin. At 14, Elaine was beginning to leave her childhood behind and to turn into the full-fledged American beauty that she eventually became. Tall, dark-haired, and blue-eyed. But in that late summer of 1978, she was the total teenaged crowd animal. She had begun with Donnie and Marie at 9, then had gotten all moony for John Travolta at 11. I made the mistake of calling him John Revolta one day, and she scratched me so badly that I almost needed a stitch in my cheek. I supposed I deserved it, sort of. At 12, she was gone for Sean. Then it was Andy Gibb. Just lately, she had developed more ominous tastes. Heavy metal rockers like Deep Purple, and a new group, Styx. I was helping Arnie get his car squared away, I said, as much to my father as to Ellie. More, really. That creep, Ellie sighed, and turned the page of her magazine. I felt a sudden and amazingly strong urge to rip the magazine out of her hands, tear it in two, and throw the pieces in her face. That went further toward showing me exactly how stressful the day had been than anything else could have done. Elaine doesn't really think Arnie's a creep. She just takes every possible opportunity to get under my skin. But maybe I'd heard Arnie called a creep too often over the last few hours. His tears were still drying on the front of my shirt, for Christ's sake. And maybe I felt a little bit creepy myself. "What's Kiss doing these days, dear?" I asked her sweetly. "Written any love letters to Eric Estrada lately?" "Oh, Eric, I die for you. I go into a total cardiac arrest every time I think of your thick, greasy lips squelching down on mine." "You're an animal," she said coldly. "Just an animal, that's all you are."
"And I don't know any better."
"That's right."
She picked up her magazine and her brown sugar sandwich and flounced away into the living room. "Don't you get that stuff on the floor, Ellie?" Dad warned her, spoiling her exit a bit. I went to the fridge and rummaged out some bologna and a tomato that didn't look as if it was working. There was also half a package of processed cheese, but wild overindulgence in that shit as a grade schooler had apparently destroyed my craving for it. I settled for a quart of milk to go with my sandwich and opened a can of Campbell's chunky beef.
"Did he get it?"
Dad asked me. My dad is a tax consultant for H&R Block. He also does freelance tax work. In the old days, he used to be a full-time accountant for the biggest architectural firm in Pittsburgh, but then he had a heart attack and got out. He's a good man.
"Yeah, he got it."
"Still look as bad to you as it did?"
"Worse. Where's Mom?"
"Her class," he said. His eyes met mine, and we both almost got the giggles. We immediately looked away in separate directions, ashamed of ourselves. But even being honestly ashamed didn't seem to help much. My mom is 43 and works as a dental hygienist. For a long time, she didn't work at her trade, but after Dad had his heart attack, she went back. 4 years ago, she decided she was an unsung writer. She began to produce poems about flowers and stories about sweet old men in the October of their years. Every now and then, she would get grittily realistic and do a story about a young girl who was tempted to take a chance, and then decided it would be immeasurably better if she saved it for the marriage bed. This summer, she had signed up for a directed writing course at Horlicks, where Michael and Regina Cunningham taught, you will remember, and was putting all her themes and stories in a book she called Sketches of Love and Beauty. Now, you could be saying to yourself, and more power to you if you are, that there is nothing funny about a woman who has managed to hold a job and also to raise her family deciding to try something new, to expand her horizons a little. And, of course, you'd be right. Also, you could be saying to yourself that my father and I had every reason to be ashamed of ourselves, that we were nothing more than a couple of male sexist pigs oinking it up in our kitchen. And again, you'd be perfectly right. I won't argue either point. Although I will say that if you had been subjected to frequent oral readings from Sketches of Love and Beauty, as Dad and I, and also Elaine, had been, you might understand the source of the giggles a little better. Well, she was and is a great mom, and I guess she is also a great wife for my father. At least I never heard him complain, and he's never stayed out all night drinking. And all I can say in our defense is that we never laughed to her face, either of us.
That's pretty poor, I know, but at least it's better than nothing. Neither of us would have hurt her like that for the world. I put a hand over my mouth and tried to squeeze the giggles off. Dad appeared to be momentarily choking on his bread and brown sugar. I didn't know what he was thinking of, but what had lodged in my mind was a fairly recent essay titled, Did Jesus Have a Dog? On top of the rest of the day, it was nearly too much. I went to the cabinets over the sink and got a glass for my milk, and when I looked back, my father had himself under control again. That helped me do likewise.
You looked sort of glum when you came in, he said. Is everything all right with Arnie, Dennis?
Arnie's cool, I said, dumping the soup into a saucepan and throwing it on the stove. He just bought a car, and that's a mess, but Arnie's all right. Of course, Arnie wasn't all right, but there are some things you can't bring yourself to tell your dad, no matter how well he's succeeding at the great American job of dadhood.
Sometimes people can't see things until they see them for themselves, he said.
Well, I said, I hope he sees it soon. He's got the car at Darnell's for 20 a week because his folks didn't want him to park it at home.
20 a week? For just a stall? Or a stall and tools?
Just a stall?
That's highway robbery.
Yeah, I said, noticing that my father didn't follow up that judgment with an offer that Arnie could park it at our place.
You want to play a game of cribbage?
I guess so, I said.
Cheer up, Dennis. You can't make other people's mistakes for them.
Yeah, really. We played three or four games of cribbage, and he beat me every time. He almost always does, unless he's very tired or has had a couple of drinks. That's okay with me, though. The times that I do beat him mean more. We played cribbage, and after a while my mother came in, her color high and her eyes glowing, looking too young to be my mom, her book of stories and sketches clasped to her breasts. She kissed my father, not her usual brush, but a real kiss that made me feel all of a sudden like I should be someplace else. She asked me the same stuff about Arnie and his car, which was fast becoming the biggest topic of conversation around the house since my mother's brother Sid went into bankruptcy and asked my dad for a loan. I went through the same song and dance. Then I went upstairs to bed. My ass was dragging, and it looked to me as if my mom and dad had business of their own to attend to, although that was a topic I never went into all that deeply in my mind, as I'm sure you'll understand. Elaine was in on her bed, listening to the latest KTEL conglomeration of hits. I asked her to turn it down because I was going to bed. She stuck out her tongue at me. No way I allowed that kind of thing. I went in and tickled her until she said she was going to puke. I said, go ahead and puke. It's your bed, and tickled her some more. Then she put on her, please don't kid me, Dennis, because this is something terribly important expression, and got all solemn and asked me if it was really true you could light farts. One of her girlfriends, Carolyn Chambliss, said it was, but Carolyn lied about almost everything. I told her to ask Milton Dodd, her dorky-looking boyfriend. Then Elaine really did get mad and tried to hit me and asked me, why do you always have to be so awful, Dennis? So I told her, yes, it was true you could light farts, and advised her not to try it. And then I gave her a hug, which I rarely did anymore. It made me uncomfortable since she started to get boobs, and so did the tickling, to tell the truth. And then I went to bed. And undressing, I thought, the day didn't end so bad after all. There are people around here who think I'm a human being, and they think Arnie is as well. I'll get him to come over tomorrow or Sunday, and we'll just hang out, watch the Phillies on TV maybe, or play some dumb board game, careers or life, or maybe that old standby Clue, and get rid of the weirdness, get feeling decent again. So I went to bed with everything straight in my mind, and I should have gone right to sleep, but I didn't, because it wasn't straight, and I knew it. Things get started, and sometimes you don't know what the hell they are. Engines. That's something else about being a teenager. There are all these engines, and somehow you end up with the ignition keys to some of them, and you start them up, but you don't know what the fuck they are or what they're supposed to do. There are clues, but that's all. The drug thing is like that, and the booze thing, and the sex thing, and sometimes other stuff too. A summer job that generates a new interest, a trip, a course in school. Engines. They give you the keys and some clues, and they say, start it up, see what it'll do. And sometimes what it does is pull you along into a life that's really good and fulfilling. And sometimes what it does is pull you right down the highway to hell and leave you all mangled and bleeding by the roadside. Engines. Big ones. Like the 382s they used to put in those old cars. Like Christine. I lay there in the dark, twisting and turning until the sheet was pulled out and all balled up and messy, and I thought about LeBay saying, "Her name is Christine." And somehow, Arnie had picked up on that. When we were little kids, we had scooters and then bikes, and I named mine, but Arnie never named his. He said names were for dogs and cats and guppies. But that was then, and this was now. Now he was calling that Plymouth Christine. And what was somehow worse, it was always her and she instead of it. I didn't like it. And I didn't know why. And even my own father had spoken of it as if, instead of buying an old junker, Arnie had gotten married. But it wasn't like that. Not at all, was it? "Stop the car, Dennis. Go back. I want to look at her again." Simple as that. No consideration at all, and that wasn't like Arnie, who usually thought things out so carefully. His life had made him all too painfully aware of what happened to guys like him when they went off half-cocked and did something, gasp, on impulse. But this time, he'd been like a man who meets a showgirl, indulges in a whirlwind courtship, and ends up with a hangover and a new wife on Monday morning. It had been, well, like love at first sight. "Never mind," I thought, "we'll start over again. Tomorrow, we'll start over. We'll get some perspective on this." And so finally I went to sleep and dreamed. The whining spin of a starter in darkness. Silence. The starter whining again. The engine fired, missed, then caught. An engine running in darkness. Then headlights came on, high beams, old-fashioned twin beams spearing me like a bug on glass. I was standing in the open doorway of Roland D. LeBay's garage, and Christine sat inside, a new Christine, with not a dent or a speck of rust on her. The clean, unblemished windshield darkened to a polarized blue strip at the top. From the radio came the hard, rhythmic sounds of Dale Hawkins doing Susie Q, a voice from a dead age, full of somehow frightening vitality. The motor muttering words of power through dual glass pack mufflers, and somehow I knew there was a Hirsch shifter inside, and fuely headers. The Quaker State oil had just been changed. It was a clean amber color, automotive lifeblood. The wipers suddenly start up, and that's strange because there's no one behind the wheel. The car is empty. "Come on, big guy. Let's go for a ride. Let's cruise." I shake my head. I don't want to get in there. I'm scared to get in there. I don't want to cruise. And suddenly the engine begins to rev and fall off. Rev and fall off. It's a hungry sound, frightening, and each time the engine revs, Christine seems to lunge forward a bit, like a mean dog on a weak leash. And I want to move, but my feet seem nailed to the cracked pavement of the driveway. "Last chance, big guy." And before I can answer, or even think of an answer, there is the terrible scream of rubber kissing off concrete, and Christine lunges out at me, her grill snarling like an open mouth full of chrome teeth, her headlights glaring. I screamed myself awake in the dead darkness of 2 a.m, the sound of my own voice scaring me, the hurried running thud of bare feet coming down the hall scaring me even worse. I had double handfuls of sheet in both hands. I'd pulled the sheet right out. It was all wadded up in the middle of the bed. My body was sweat, slippery. Down the hall, Ellie cried out, "What was that?" in her own terror. My light flooded on, and there was my mom, in a shorty nightgown that showed more than she would have allowed except in the direst of emergencies, and, right behind her, my dad, belting his bathrobe closed over nothing at all.
"Honey, what is it?"
my mom asked me. Her eyes were wide and scared. I couldn't remember the last time she had called me honey like that when I was 14, 12, 10 maybe? I don't know.
"Dennis?"
Dad asked. Then Elaine was standing behind and between them, shivering.
"Go back to bed," I said. "It was a dream, that's all. Nothing." Wow,
Elaine said, shocked into respect by the hour and the occasion.
Must have been a real horror movie. What was it, Dennis?
I dreamed that you married Milton Dodd and then came to live with me, I said.
Don't tease your sister, Mom said. What was it, Dennis?
I don't remember, I said.
I was suddenly aware that the sheet was a mess and there was a dark tuft of pubic hair poking out. I rearranged things in a hurry, with guilty thoughts of masturbation, wet dreams, God knows what else shooting through my head, total dislocation. For the first spinning moment or two, I hadn't even been sure if I was big or little. There was only that dark, terrifying, and overmastering image of the car lunging forward a little each time the engine revved, dropping back, lunging forward again, the hood vibrating over the engine bucket, the grill like steel teeth. Last chance, big guy. Then my mother's hand, cool and dry, was on my forehead, hunting fever.
It's all right, Mom, I said. It was nothing, just a nightmare.
But you don't remember.
No, it's gone now.
I was scared,
she said, and then uttered a shaky little laugh.
I guess you don't know what scared is until one of your kids screams in the dark.
Ah, gross, don't talk about it, Elaine said.
Go back to bed, little one,
Dad said, and gave her butt a light swat. She went, not looking totally happy about it. Maybe once she was over her own initial fright, she was hoping I'd break down and have hysterics. That would have given her a real scoop with the training bra set down at the rec program in the morning.
You really okay? My mother asked. Dennis? Hun?
That word again. Bringing back memories of knees scraped falling out of my red wagon, her face lingering over my bed as it had while I lay in the feverish throes of all those childhood illnesses, mumps, measles, a bout of scarlatina, making me feel absurdly like crying. I had 9 inches and 70 pounds on her.
Sure,
I said.
All right, she said. Leave the light on. Sometimes it helps.
And with a final doubtful look at my dad, she went out. I had something to be bemused about, the idea that my mother had ever had a nightmare. One of those things that never occur to you, I guess. Whatever her nightmares were, none of them had ever found their way into sketches of love and beauty. My dad sat down on the bed.
You really don't remember what it was about?
I shook my head.
Must have been bad to make you yell like that, Dennis.
His eyes were on mine, gravely asking if there was something he should know. I almost told him. The car, it was Arnie's goddamn car, Christine the Rust Queen, 20 years old, ugly fucking thing. I almost told him. But then somehow it choked in my throat, almost as if to speak would have been to betray my friend. Good old Arnie, whom a fun-loving god had decided to swat with the ugly stick.
All right, he said,
and kissed my cheek. I could feel his beard, those stiff little bristles that only come out at night. I could smell his sweat and feel his love. I hugged him hard, and he hugged me back. Then they were all gone, and I lay there with the bed table lamp burning, afraid to go back to sleep. I got a book and lay back down, knowing that my folks were lying awake downstairs in their room, wondering if I was in some kind of a mess, or if I had gotten someone else, the cheerleader with the fantastic body, maybe, in some kind of a mess. I decided sleep was an impossibility. I would read until daylight and catch a nap tomorrow afternoon, maybe, during the dull part of the ballgame. And thinking that, I fell asleep, and woke up in the morning with the book lying unopened, on the floor beside the bed. Chapter 8. First Changes. I thought Arnie would turn up that Saturday, so I hung around the house, mowed the lawn, cleaned up the garage, even washed all 3 cars. My mother watched all this industry with some amazement and commented over a lunch of hot dogs and green salad that maybe I should have nightmares more often. I didn't want to phone Arnie's house, not after all the unpleasantness I had seen there lately. But when the pregame show came on and he still hadn't shown, I took my courage in my hands and called. Regina answered, and although she was doing a good facsimile of nothing has changed, I thought I detected a new coolness in her voice. It made me feel sad. Her only son had been seduced by a baggy old whore named Christine, and old buddy Dennis must have been an accomplice. Maybe he had even pimped the deal. Arnie wasn't home, she said. He was at Darnell's garage. He had been there since 9 that morning. Oh, I said lamely. Oh, wow, I didn't know that. It sounded like a lie. Even more, it felt like a lie.
No,
Regina said in that new, cool way. Goodbye, Dennis. The phone was dead in my hand. I looked at it a while and then hung up. Dad was parked in front of the TV in his gross purple Bermudas and his Jesus shoes. A six-pack of Strohs crashed down in the cooler beside him. The Phillies were having a good day, belting the almighty hell out of Atlanta. My mom had gone out to visit one of her classmates. I think they read each other their sketches and poems and got exalted together. Elaine had gone over to her friend Della's house. Our place was quiet. Outside, the sun played tag with a few benign white clouds. Dad gave me a beer, which he does only when he's feeling extraordinarily mellow. But Saturday still felt flat. I kept thinking of Arnie, not watching the Phillies or soaking up the rays, not even mowing the grass over at his house and getting his feet green. Arnie in the oily shadows of Will Darnell's do-it-yourself garage, playing games with that silent, rusting hulk while men shouted and tools clanged on the cement with that piercing white metal sound, the machine gun drill of pneumatic guns loosening old bolts, Will Darnell's wheezy voice and asthmatic cough. And goddammit, was I jealous? Was that what it was? When the seventh inning came along, I got up and started to go out.
Where are you going?
My dad asked. Yeah. Just where was I going? Down there? To watch him? Cluck over him? Listen to Will Darnell get on his case? Heading for another dose of misery? Fuck it, Arnie was a big boy now. No place, I said. I found a Twinkie tucked carefully away in the back of the bread box and took it with a certain doleful glee, knowing how pissed Elaine was going to be when she schlepped out during one of the commercials on Saturday Night Live and found it gone. No place at all. I came back into the living room and sat down and cadged another beer off my dad and ate Elaine's Twinkie and even lapped the cardboard it had been on. We watched Philly finish the job of ruining Atlanta. They root 'em, Denny, I could hear my grandfather, now 5 years dead, saying in his cackly old man's voice, they root 'em good. I didn't think about Arnie Cunningham at all. Hardly at all. He came over on his tacky old three-speed the next afternoon while Elaine and I were playing croquet on the back lawn. Elaine kept accusing me of cheating. She was on one of her rips. Elaine always went on rips when she was getting her period. Elaine was very proud of her period. She had been having one regularly all of 14 months. Hey, Arnie said, ambling around the corner of the house. It's either the creature from the Black Lagoon and the Bride of Frankenstein or Dennis and Ellie.
What do you say, man? I asked. Grab a mallet.
I'm not playing, Elaine said, throwing her mallet down. He cheats even worse than you do. Men.
As she stalked off, Arnie said in a trembling, affected voice,
That's the first time she ever called me a man, Dennis.
He fell to his knees, a look of exalted adoration on his face. I started laughing. He could do it good when he wanted to, Arnie could. That was one of the reasons I liked him as well as I did. And it was a kind of secret thing, you know? I don't think anyone really saw that wit except me. I once heard about some millionaire who had a stolen Rembrandt in his basement where no one but him could see it. I could understand that guy. I don't mean that Arnie was a Rembrandt or even a world-class wit, but I could understand the attraction of knowing about something good, something that was good, but still a secret. We goofed around the croquet course for a while, not really playing, just whopping the Jesus out of each other's balls. Finally, one went through the hedge into the Blackfords' yard, and after I crawled through to get it, neither of us wanted to play anymore. We sat down in the lawn chairs. Pretty soon our cat, Screamin' Jay Hawkins, Captain Beefheart's replacement, came creeping out from under the porch,
probably hoping to find some cute little chipmunk to murder slowly and nastily. His amber-green eyes glinted in the afternoon light, which was overcast and muted.
"Thought you'd be over for the game yesterday," I said. "It was a good one."
"I was at Darnell's," he said. "I heard it on the radio, though." His voice went up 3 octaves, and he did a very good imitation of my granddad.
"They ruined him! They ruined him, Denny!"
I laughed and nodded. There was something about him that day. Perhaps it was only the light, which was bright enough, but still somehow gloomy and spare. Something that looked different. He looked tired, for one thing. There were circles under his eyes. But at the same time, his complexion seemed a trifle better than it had been lately. He'd been drinking a lot of Cokes on the job, knowing he shouldn't, of course, but unable to help succumbing to temptation from time to time. His skin problems tended to go in cycles, as most teenagers do, depending on their moods. Except in Arnie's case, the cycles were usually from bad to worse and back to bad again. Or maybe it was just the light.
"What'd you do on it?" I asked.
"Not much.
Changed the oil.
Look the block over. It's not cracked, Dennis. That's one thing. LeBay or somebody left the drain plug out somewhere along the line, that's all. A lot of the old oil had leaked out. I was lucky not to fry a piston driving it Friday night."
"How'd you get lift time? I thought you had to reserve that in advance."
His eyes shifted away from mine. "No problem there," he said. But there was deception in his voice.
"I ran a couple of errands for Mr. Darnell."
I opened my mouth to ask what errands, and then I decided I didn't want to hear. Probably the couple of errands boiled down to no more than running around the corner to Shermer's Luncheonette and bringing back coffee and for the regulars, or crating up various used auto parts for later sale. But I didn't want to be involved in the Christine end of Arnie's life, and that included how he was getting along, or not getting along, down at Darnell's garage. And there was something else. A feeling of letting go. I either couldn't define that feeling very well back then, or didn't want to. Now, I guess I'd say it's the way you feel when a friend of yours falls in love and marries a right high-riding, dyed-in-the-wool bitch. You don't like the bitch, and in 99 cases out of 100, the bitch doesn't like you, so you just close the door on that room of your friendship. When the thing is done, you either let go of the subject, or you find your friend letting go of you. Usually with the bitch's enthusiastic approval.
"Let's go to the movies," Arnie said restlessly. "What's on?" "Well, there's one of those gross kung fu movies down at the State Twin. How does that sound?"
"Hee-yah!"
He pretended to administer a savage karate kick to Screamin' Jay Hawkins, and Screamin' Jay took off like a shot.
"Sounds pretty good, Bruce Lee."
"Nah, some other guy."
"What's it called?"
"I don't know. Fists of Danger, Flying Hands of Death, or maybe it was Genitals of Fury, I don't know. What do you say? We can come back and tell the gross parts to Ellie and make her puke."
"All right," I said, "if we can still get in for a buck each."
"Yeah, we can until 3.
"Let's go."
We went. It turned out to be a Chuck Norris movie. Not bad at all. And on Monday, we went back to building the interstate extension. I forgot about my dream. Gradually, I realized that I wasn't seeing as much of Arnie as I used to. Again, it was the way you seem to fall out of touch with a guy who's just gotten married. Besides, my thing with the cheerleader began to heat up around then. My thing was heating up all right. More than one night, I brought her home from the submarine races at the drive-in with my balls throbbing so badly I could barely walk. Arnie, meanwhile, was spending most of his evenings at Darnell's.
Chapter 9. Buddy Repperton. Our last full week of work before school started was the week before Labor Day. When I pulled up to Arnie's house to pick him up that morning, he came out with a great big blue-black shiner around one eye and an ugly scrape upside his face.
"What happened to you?"
"I don't want to talk about it," he said sullenly. "I had to talk to my parents about it until I thought I was going to croak." He tossed his lunch pail in back and lapsed into a grim silence that lasted all the way to work. Some of the other guys ribbed him about his shiner, but Arnie just shrugged it off. I didn't say anything about it on the way home, just played the radio and kept myself to myself. And I might not have heard the story at all if I hadn't been waylaid by this greasy Irish wop named Gino just before we turned off Main Street. Back then, Gino was always waylaying me. He could reach right through a closed car window and do it. Gino's Fine Italian Pizza is on the corner of Main and Basin Drive, and every time I saw that sign with the pizza going up in the air and all the eyes dotted with shamrocks, it flashed off and on at night. How funky can you get, am I right? I'd feel the waylaying start again. And tonight, my mother would be in class, which meant a pickup supper at home. The prospect didn't fill me with joy. Neither my dad nor I was much of a cook, and Ellie would burn water. "Let's get a pizza," I said, pulling into Gino's parking lot. "What do you say? A big greasy one that smells like armpits." "Jesus, Dennis, that's gross." "Clean armpits," I amended. "Come on." "No, I'm pretty low on cash," Arnie said listlessly. "I'll buy. You can even have those horrible fucking anchovies on your half. What do you say?"
"Dennis, I really don't."
"And a Pepsi," I said.
"Pepsi racks my complexion, you know that."
"Yeah, I know. A great big Pepsi, Arnie." His gray eyes gleamed for the first time that day.
"A great big Pepsi?" he echoed. "Think of that. You're mean, Dennis, really."
"Two if you want," I said. It was mean, all right, like offering Hershey bars to the circus fat lady.
"Two," he said, clutching my shoulder. "Two Pepsis, Dennis."
He began to flop around in the seat, clawing at his throat and screaming,
"Two, quick, two, quick."
I was laughing so hard I almost drove into the cinder block wall, and as we got out of the car, I thought, why shouldn't he have a couple of sodas? He sure must have been steering clear of them lately. The slight improvement in his complexion I'd noticed on that overcast Sunday 2 weeks ago was definite now. He still had plenty of bumps and craters, but not so many of them were, pardon me, but I must say it, oozing. He looked better in other ways, too. A summer of road ganging had left him deeply tanned and in better shape than he'd ever been in his life. So I thought he deserved his Pepsi. To the victor goes the spoils. Gino's is run by a wonderful Italian fellow named Pat Donahue. He has a sticker on his cash register which reads, "Irish Mafia," and he serves green beer on St. Patrick's Day. On March 17, you can't get near Gino's, and one of the cuts on the jukebox is Rosemary Clooney singing "When Irish Eyes Are Smiling," and affects a black derby hat, which he usually wears tipped far back on his head. The juke is an old Wurlitzer bubbler, a holdover from the late 40s, and all the records, not just Rosemary Clooney, are on the prehistoric label. It may be the last jukebox in America where you get three plays for a quarter. On the infrequent occasions when I smoke a little dope, it's Gino's I fantasize about. Just walking in there and ordering three loaded pizzas, a quart of Pepsi, and six or seven of Pat Donahue's homemade fudge brownies. Then I imagine just sitting down and scarfing everything up while a steady stream of Beach Boys and Rolling Stones hits pours out of that juke. We went in, ordered up, and sat there watching the three pizza cooks fling the dough into the air and catch it. They were trading such pungent Italian witticisms as, "I seen you at the Shriners dance last night, Howie. Who was that skag your brother was with?" "Oh, huh, that was your sister." I mean, like, how old world can you get? People came in and went out, a lot of them kids from school. Before long, I'd be seeing them in the halls again, and I felt a recurrence of that fierce nostalgia in advance and that same sense of fright. In my head, I could hear the homeroom bell going off, but somehow its long bray sounded like an alarm. "Here we go again, Dennis. Last time. After this year, you gotta learn how to be a grown-up." I could hear locker doors crashing closed. Could hear the steady ka-chunk, ka-chunk, ka-chunk of linemen hitting the tackling dummies. Could hear Marty Bellerman yelling exuberantly, "My ass in your face, Patterson! Remember that! My ass in your face! It's easier to tell the fucking Bobbsey twins apart!" The dry smell of chalk dust in the classrooms in the math wing. The sound of the typewriters from the big secretarial classrooms on the second floor. Mr. Meacham, the principal, giving the announcements at the end of the day in his dry, fussy voice. Lunch outdoors on the bleachers in good weather. A new crop of freshmen looking dorky and lost. And at the end of it all, you march down the aisle in this big purple bathrobe. And that's it. High school's over. You are released on an unsuspecting world.
Dennis, do you know Buddy Repperton?
Arnie asked, pulling me out of my reverie. Our pizza had come.
Buddy who?
Repperton.
The name was familiar. I worked on my side of the pizza and tried to put a face with it. After a while, it came. I had had a run-in with him when I was one of the dorky little freshmen. It happened at a mixer dance. The band was taking a break, and I was waiting in the cold drink line to get a soda. Repperton gave me a shove and told me freshmen had to wait until all the upperclassmen got drinks. He had been a sophomore then, a big, hulking, mean sophomore. He had a lantern jaw, a thick clot of greasy black hair, and little eyes set too close together. But those eyes were not entirely stupid. An unpleasant intelligence lurked in them. He was one of those guys who spend their high school time majoring in smoking area. I had advanced the heretical opinion that class seniority didn't mean anything in the refreshment line. Repperton invited me to come outside with him. By then, the cold drink line had broken up and rearranged itself into one of those cautious but eager little circles that so often presage a scuffle. One of the chaperones came along and broke it up. Repperton promised he would get me, but he never did. And that had been my only contact with him, except for seeing his name every now and then on the detention list that circulated to the homerooms at the end of the day. It seemed to me that he'd been dismissed from school a couple of times, too, and when that happened, it was usually a pretty good sign that the guy wasn't in the Young Christian League. I told Arnie about my one experience with Repperton, and he nodded wearily. He touched the shiner, which was now turning a gruesome lemon color.
He was the one.
Repperton messed up your face?
Yeah.
Arnie told me he knew Repperton from the auto shop courses. One of the ironies of Arnie's rather hunted and certainly unhappy school life was that his interests and abilities took him into direct contact with the sort of people who feel it is their appointed duty to kick the stuffing out of the Arnie Cunninghams of this world. When Arnie was a sophomore and taking a course called Engine Fundamentals, which used to be plain old Auto Shop 1 before the school got a whole bunch of vocational training money from the federal government, a kid named Roger Gilman beat the living shit out of him. That's pretty fucking vulgar, I know, but there's just no fancy, elegant way to put it. Gilman just beat the living shit out of Arnie. The beating was bad enough to keep Arnie out of school for a couple of days, and Gilman got a one-week vacation courtesy of the management. Gilman was now in prison on a hijacking charge. Buddy Repperton had been part of Roger Gilman's circle of friends, and had more or less inherited leadership of Gilman's group. For Arnie, going to class in the shop area was like visiting a demilitarized zone. Then, if he got back alive after period 7, he'd run all the way to the other end of the school with his chessboard and men under his arm for a chess club meeting or a game. I remember going to a city chess tourney in Squirrel Hill one day the year before, and seeing something which, to me, symbolized my friend's schizo school life. There he was, hunched gravely over his board, in the thick, carved silence, which is mostly what you hear at such affairs. After a long, thoughtful pause, he moved a rook, with a hand into which grease and motor oil had been so deeply grimed that not even Boraxo would take it all out. Of course, not all the shoppies were out to get him. There were plenty of good kids down that way, but a lot of them were either into their own tight circles of friends or permanently stoned. The ones in the tight little cliques were usually from the poorer section of Libertyville. And don't ever let anyone tell you high school students aren't tracked according to what part of town they come from. They are. Very serious and so quiet, you might make the mistake of dismissing them as stupid. Most of them look like leftovers from 1968, with their long hair tied back in ponytails, and their jeans, and their tie-dyed t-shirts. But in 1978, none of these guys wanted to overthrow the government. They wanted to grow up to be Mr. Goodwrench. And shop is still the final stopping place for the misfits and hardasses who aren't so much attending school as they are being incarcerated there. And now that Arnie brought up Repperton's name, I could think of several guys who circled him like a planetary system. Most of them were 20 and still struggling to get out of school. Don Vandenberg, Sandy Galton, Moochie Welch. Moochie's real name was Peter, but the kids all called him Moochie because you always saw him outside of the rock concerts in Pittsburgh, spare changing.
Buddy Repperton had come by a 2-year-old blue Camaro that had been rolled over a couple of times out on Route 46 near Squanic Hills State Park. He picked it up from one of Darnell's poker buddies, Arnie said. The engine was okay, but the body had really taken chong from the tong and the rollover. Repperton brought it into Darnell's about a week after Arnie brought Christine in, although Buddy had been hanging around even before that. For the first couple of days, Repperton hadn't appeared to notice Arnie at all, and Arnie, of course, was just as happy not to be noticed. Repperton was on good terms with Darnell, though. He seemed to have no trouble obtaining high-demand tools that were usually only available on a reserve basis. Then Repperton had started getting on Arnie's case. He'd walk by on his way back from the Coke machine or the bathroom and knock a box full of ball joint wrench attachments that Arnie was using all over the floor in Arnie's stall. Or if Arnie had a coffee on a shelf, Repperton would manage to hit it with his elbow and spill it. Then he'd bugle, "Well, excuse me," like Steve Martin, with this big shit-eating grin on his face. Darnell would holler over for Arnie to pick up those attachments before one of them went down through a drain in the floor or something. Soon Repperton was swerving out of his way to give Arnie a whistling clap on the back, accompanied by a bellowed, "How you doing, cunt face?" Arnie bore these opening salvos with the stoicism of a guy who has seen it all before, been through it all before. He was probably hoping for one of two things. Either that the harassment would reach a constant level of annoyance and stop there, or that Buddy Repperton would find some other victim and move on. There was a third possibility as well, one almost too good to hope for. It was always possible that Buddy would get righteously busted for something and just disappear from the scene, like his old buddy Roger Gilman. It had come to blows on the Saturday afternoon just past. Arnie was doing a grease job on his car, mostly because he hadn't yet accumulated sufficient funds to do any of the 100 other things the car cried out for. Repperton came by, whistling cheerfully, a Coke and a bag of peanuts in one hand, a jackhandle in the other. And as he passed stall 20, he whipped the jackhandle out sidearm and broke one of Christine's headlights. "Smashed it to shit," Arnie told me over our pizza. "Oh, jeez, look at what I did," Buddy Repperton had said, an exaggerated expression of tragedy on his face. "Well, excuse—" But that was all he got out. The attack on Christine managed what the attacks on Arnie himself hadn't been able to do. It provoked him into retaliation. He came around the side of the Plymouth, hands balled into fists, and struck out blindly. In a book or a movie, he probably would have socked Repperton right on the old knockout button and put him on the floor for a 10-count. Things rarely work out that way in real life. Arnie didn't get anywhere near Repperton's chin. Instead, he hit Repperton's hand, knocked the bag of peanuts on the floor, and spilled Coca-Cola all over Repperton's face and shirt. "All right, you fucking little prick," Repperton cried. He looked almost comically stunned. "There goes your ass." He came for Arnie with the jackhandle. Several of the other men ran over then, and one of them told Repperton to drop the jackhandle and fight fair. Repperton threw it away and waded in. "Darnell never tried to put a stop to it?" I asked Arnie. "He wasn't there, Dennis. He disappeared 15 minutes or half an hour before it started. It's like he knew it was going to happen." Arnie said that Repperton had done most of the damage right away. The black eye was first, the scrape on his face, made by the class ring Repperton had purchased during one of his many sophomore years, came directly afterward. "Plus assorted other bruises," he said. "What other bruises?" We were sitting in one of the back booths. Arnie glanced around to make sure no one was looking at us, and then raised his t-shirt. I hissed in breath at what I saw. A terrific sunset of bruises, yellow, red, purple, brown, covered Arnie's chest and stomach. They were just starting to fade. How he had been able to come to work after getting mashed around like that, I couldn't begin to understand. "Man, are you sure he didn't spring any of your ribs?" I asked. I was really horrified. The shiner and the scrape looked tame next to this shit. I had seen high school scuffles, of course, had even been in a few, but I was looking at the results of a serious beating for the first time in my life. "Pretty sure," he said levelly.
I was lucky.
I guess you were. Arnie didn't say a lot more, but a kid I knew named Randy Turner was there, and he filled me in on what had happened in more detail after school had started again. He said that Arnie might have gotten hurt a lot worse, but he came back at Buddy a lot harder and a lot madder than Buddy had expected. In fact, Randy said, Arnie went after Buddy Repperton as if the devil had blown a charge of red pepper up his ass. His arms were windmilling, his fists were everywhere. He was yelling, cursing, spraying spittle. I tried to picture it and couldn't. The picture I kept coming up with instead was Arnie slamming his fists down on my dashboard hard enough to make dents, screaming that he would make them eat it. He drove Repperton halfway across the garage, bloodied his nose, more by good luck than good aim, and got one to Repperton's throat that made him start to cough and gag and generally lose interest in busting Arnie Cunningham's ass. Buddy turned away, holding his throat and trying to puke, and Arnie drove one of his steel-toed work boots into Repperton's jeans-clad butt, knocking him flat on his belly and forearms. Repperton was still gagging and holding his throat with one hand. His nose was bleeding like mad, and, again, according to Randy Turner, Arnie was apparently gearing up to kick the son of a bitch to death when Will Darnell magically reappeared, hollering in his wheezy voice to cut the shit over there, cut the shit, cut the shit. Arnie thought that fight was going to happen, I told Randy. He thought it was a put-up job. Randy shrugged.
Maybe. Could be. Sure was funny the way Darnell showed up when Repperton really started to lose.
About seven guys grabbed Arnie and dragged him away. At first he fought them like a wild man, screaming for them to let him go, screaming that if Repperton didn't pay for the broken headlight, he'd kill him. Then he subsided, bewildered and hardly aware how it had happened that Repperton was down and he was still on his feet. Repperton finally got up, his white t-shirt smeared with dirt and grease, his nose still bubbling blood. He made a lunge for Arnie. Randy said it looked like a pretty half-hearted lunge, mostly for form's sake. Some of the other guys got hold of him and led him away. Darnell came over to Arnie and told him to hand in his toolbox key and get out.
Jesus, Arnie, why didn't you call me Saturday afternoon?
He sighed.
I was too depressed.
We finished our pizza, and I bought Arnie a third Pepsi. That stuff's murder on your complexion, but it's great for depression.
I don't know if he meant to get out just for Saturday or from then on, Arnie said to me on our way home. What do you think, Dennis? You think he kicked me out for good?
He asked for your toolbox key, you said.
Yeah, he did. I never got kicked out of any place before.
He looked like he was going to cry.
A place bites the root anyway. Will Darnell's an asshole.
I guess it would be stupid to try and keep it there anymore anyway, he said. Even if Darnell lets me come back, Repperton's there. I'd fight him again.
I started to hum the theme from Rocky.
Yeah, fuck you and the cayuse you rode in on, Range Rider, he said, smiling a little. I really would fight him. But Repperton might take after her with that jackhandle again when I wasn't there. I don't think Darnell would stop him if he did.
I didn't answer, and maybe Arnie thought that meant I agreed with him. But I didn't. I didn't think his old rust bucket Plymouth Fury was the main target. And if Repperton felt that he couldn't accomplish the demolition of the main target by himself, he would simply get by with a little help from his friends, Don Vandenberg, Moochie Welch, et al. Get on your motorhuckle boots, boys. We got plenty good stomping tonight. It occurred to me that they could kill him. Not just kill him, but really, honest to Christ, kill him. Guys like that sometimes did. Things just went a little too far, and some kid wound up dead. You read about it in the papers sometimes.
Keeper?
Huh? I hadn't followed that. Up ahead, Arnie's house was in view.
I asked if you had any ideas about where I could keep her.
The car, that's all he could talk about. He was starting to sound like a broken record. And worse, it was always her. He was bright enough to see his growing obsession with her, it. But he wasn't picking it up. He wasn't picking it up at all.
Arnie, I said, my man, you've got more important things to worry about than where to keep the car. I want to know where you're going to keep you. Huh? What are you talking about?
I'm asking you what you're going to do if Buddy and Buddy's buddies decide they want to put you in traction.